Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, the 27th of June, year 2000. We are in the fireside room this morning. Your presenter's name is Eunice Scarf. And her session is entitled Writing Memoir, Recording Your Inheritance, Blank Page, Act and Art of Writing the Self 2. Today's session is entitled SCE 2000-2. Let's listen in.
You're reading at the moment. This is just for openers while we wait for them to come in. What are you reading?
You know, I was going to bring a book down that I have with, whose title I can't even remember. I think it's called A Daughter Remembers. Mm-hmm. And it's written by Friar Manfred, whose mm-hmm. father was Frederick Manfred, a real prolific writer. Mm-hmm. And in it, she writes about her conversations with her father and her feelings and the encouragement he gave her, speaking as a writer to a daughter writer.
Okay, A Daughter Remembers. Anyone else? Thank you.
I'm reading The Life of Charlotte Bronte. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Gaskell, the author.
Elizabeth Gaskell, the author. That's a classic. The Life of Charlotte Bronte, who, little less than 150 years ago, had to submit her text under a male pseudonym in order to find a publisher.
Oh, I didn't even know
Charlotte and the sister, she was Courier Belle when she submitted her manuscript, and when the publisher finally met her, he looked over her shoulder for who the real author was, and she said, me. Anyone else, what are you reading while you're here?
Reading both The Sunflower, the book for the village, this is mm-hmm. one of them. Mm-hmm.
Desmond Tutu, Thing on Forgiveness. Thank you. Anyone else?
I just finished Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Dreams for probably the eighth time.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just starting a book called Malde Amores. Malde Amores.
It's in Spanish. Okay. Eight times for Barbara Kingsolver. How many of you have read The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver? All right. I mention her because yesterday I asked the question, if you have grown up or are now in a religious tradition, and I dare to make that assumption, you have some connection with a tradition or an institution in which you live and move and have your being. If you are in a tradition, where is the story of the tradition you grew up in or currently practice in? And Kingsolver puts Protestantism on the map in ways that I haven't seen done before, and I've been looking for texts that put anything that reminds me of my upbringing. I was never a missionary's daughter in, Cameroon. But there are aspects of that that I can see, aha, there's my story. I've been tracking my story in text, and I ask you, where have you found your story in text up to this point?
I remember the first time I ever thought Lutherans were interesting enough for any attention at all.
I hope this is on the tape. Wondered whether Lutherans were interesting enough for any attention at all in text.
Garrison Keillor.
Right.
You know, I was astonished that he just found this interesting enough to even pay attention to. And I think those of us who were raised Lutheran, especially in the U.S.,
all right, how many of you can say you may have felt or thought something similar to this? Please, hands. I was surprised when we were interesting enough to turn up in a public document that is of literary or performance. Garrison Keillor. Yes. There's a whole lot more to be said by that, but I'm going to have a pause and ask for more text. Anything else you're reading? Yes.
I'm reading Isaiah Berlin's very interesting collection of ethics, of essays, and particularly the one called The Hedgehog and the Fox.
The Hedgehog and the Fox.
Sort of a classic essay.
Is it small or is it a fat text? Does he do something large with it?
It's about 8 pages.
Okay.
It's in a huge book called The Essays, The Hedgehog and the Fox.
The
fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows only one thing well.
I had no trouble with the hedgehog, just by the by, after our discussion last night. Just various and sundry people wanted to know more about the hedgehog. She missed the point entirely. What kind of hedgehog? Where does this hedgehog live? Hedgehog knows one thing, the fox knows many things. I just finished when I came here. In fact, I could hardly tear myself away from it in enough time to see the mountains. Blindness by the Portuguese writer who won the Nobel Prize, and I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's spelled Saragamo. Saramago would be the phonetic spelling pronunciation. An allegory extended in which one after another the entire civilization goes blind. And what he does with that allegory is enormous. It moves out like the ripples from a pond. And it's simply called blindness. He has also written a fiction called The Gospel of Jesus Christ. And you might take a look at what he does with that if the writer interests you. All right, any one more book and then we'll do our formal beginning. Yes.
I just finished reading three books, The Shunning, The Reckoning, and I can't remember the third title. I want to say Norris, but I'm not sure of that either. It's the story of the Amish people.
Okay.
And that was very interesting.
Story of the Amish people. What brought you to the Amish people? Do you have roots or?
None at all. Okay. This book was recommended and it's just such a good reading.
The Shunning is a particular, how many of you recognize that word? I mean, we know what it means, but it has a very specific definition in, I believe I could say Anabaptist, Mennonite or Amish, where the community together institutes a shunning on its own, one of its own individuals, enacts a shunning. And it's very specific. It's alive and well, according to a few Mennonite friends I have. It isn't something that is disappeared. All right. My name is Eunice Scarfe. I spend my life, that is from January to January, either writing story or teaching classes like this in which I ask you, do you have a blank page and where are you going to start? There are many ways to express story, I said yesterday. We could dance it, we could sculpt it, we could stitch it. We can weave it. We can paint it. Today, I'm saying, of all the ways in which one could express story, you have pen and paper, and we will spend some time. You'll have 20 minutes today. If you spent 20 minutes for a year, by the way, you'd have a large number of pages. Well, this is to get you into a process, which you can continue if you like. It's also a process that I invite you to take back and work with a group on your own, and I have with me, though not in the room at the moment, a handbook for working a writing group. In the way in which you will do every day that you choose to come here, if you choose to come to write. So in my mind, you are getting both a process today and a piece of your story today and a process to take away with you. That begs the question, why write? Why enter into story? And frankly, at this moment in time, I realized coming down the hill that none of my answers serve anyone else. They only serve me. Why write? Why enter into story? Why record from your own life experience? Why go into imagination and make an invented or imaginary text? After all, given the state of the world, what purpose is there in putting pen to paper? Believe me, I'm playing devil's advocate here because I wouldn't do this if I didn't believe there was a purpose. What purpose is there in creating texts out of memory or out of imagination that have their life of their own, permanent life in the world? Yesterday, I had one answer, and I leave that question with you. I'd like to close at the end, but sometimes the closing, there's so many of us reading, we don't get to it. Why write? Why record your own story? Is this a huge act of ego, me, myself, and I? Here I am on the page, this is my story. Is it a way of gathering together the fragments of your own lived experience in order to do a look at what is the story you've lived? Is it a way of actually recording what you've inherited? That is, and that's our theme this week, Heirs According to Promise. What have you inherited? In which stories are you living inside of that are part of your inheritance? That is, coming out of a religious tradition, a cultural tradition, an ethnic tradition, an extended family tradition. And I'm not talking here just about the document of facts of genealogy. I'm talking about story, which always answers or raises the question, why? How come? And always raises the question of how many different versions there are of any given narrative. So you could tell the story, and if your mother told the same story, I dare say they'd be different. Well, those are questions I raise. When we look at stories we've inherited, we also think about the story we're going to pass on. What legacy are you going to leave? what moment in time are you going to witness for those who come after you to see and experience by virtue of what you put down on the page? So I'm reading from things today, and this is the way we move forward. Actually, I think I should stop here. I raised a question, raised some possible answers. Does anyone want to throw out one or two? There are multifarious answers to the question of why story. Anybody want to throw out an answer? I love what we heard yesterday from Bob. There are no wrong answers. You ask me a question in Midrash, so there are no wrong answers to this question either. Why write?
It can be very healing.
It can be healing.
Resolve a problem going through your mind. Mm-hmm.
All right.
After you write a while, you look at both and write.
Okay. It's healing for the narrator to see all sides. Thank you.
And just to hear one's voice.
To hear one's own voice.
That often gets lost or unheard.
All right.
It's a safe place to begin.
A safe place to begin with my own story, my own voice, as opposed to being lost in a larger collection. Other reasons?
My father was a wonderful storyteller, and so I would listen to him in his last years and write down little notes about what he had to say, and as I've written down his stories, it's been a way for me to sort of inhabit the life he lived in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and also as a way to sort of hang on to him.
All right. Thank you. Two good reasons. Someone has said writing means you live a life twice. You live it, and then you relive it as you write it, and you've extended that into your father's story. Over here?
I think of my daughter's phrase, "Oh, Mom, you never told me that. I didn't know that about you."
Okay.
Simple things that you have done, you don't think too much about.
It is so familiar to you, you wonder whether there's any point in making a record. Surely everyone knows, all right? You never told me. Which goes into the second half of the two questions regarding inheritance. What do we inherit? What have you gotten? Some of you are rich with story that has been passed on to you in a very personal context. What are you willing to pass on? And have you done your job? Mm-hmm. Have you done your gift of story to those who come after? Yes?
This little journal has a quote from Ursula Le Guin, who says, "We read books to find out who we are." And mm-hmm. I suspect that we write
okay, it's a question of identity or pursuit of identity. And it's that question, I think, of seeing my identity in story that set me on my search 20 years ago. Looking for where I could see a fully realized, fully told story of a life that was like mine. And I didn't find many from my particular tradition and origin. I had to go back to Giants in the Earth, 1928, the immigrants coming from Scandinavia to the Great Plains, Roald calls it. And I thought, that's a bit dated. It's the first generation. Those were my people. That is the decade my people came. But there's been nothing since then. And I've been searching rigorously ever since what has happened. And then I realized it's not just my story, it's all those who have relocated. There is a common denominator, relocation, loss of one place, re-entry into the next one. For example, I'll give you one more. I grew up out of Haugi tradition. How many of you recognize the word Haugi tradition, pietism? Those people that came who were influenced by Haugi in Norway, who believed that the state church, the official collar and training of the state church were not required, Haugi believed. Such training was not required to deliver the sacraments, administer the sacraments, or to pray, or to bless, or to marry, or to bury. And he was jailed. It's part of interesting Norwegian history for having taken the presumption. Those people who became or were in that pietist movement influenced those who came, influenced the colleges that were set up, influenced the... And I don't know, you're in a Lutheran setting, and there are many of the Lutheran people who represent different strands, whether it's a high church where the collar get trained in the center or the low church, feel called by God in a very individual way. I knew nothing of this. And those of you who said you knew Haugi or any other part of your tradition, who's told you the story to make sense of the world in which you are presently living? So those are questions. Do you have the story of where you came from, have you passed on the story of what experience you are now living? Let's read. What I do is read from a couple passages and then invite you to write for 15 or 20 minutes. I choose the passages for several reasons. The style might be a style you want to choose. The subject might be the subject you want to choose. Or you might want to ignore me entirely. Writers are usually single-mindedly resistant to authority. So I will give you some suggestions and assume that a couple of you will say, no, I've got something else on my mind today. I'm going to use these 15, 20 minutes to write what I want to write. There is no assignment. There's a catalyst, and you can go any direction you want with it. So let's begin. The first one, and I'm going to read two or three of them, and I suggest that you write down what you're hearing so you know. I like to give credit to the writer. If you have a quote from the writer, that you know who that belongs to. But secondly, there's paper over here and some pens, pencils. Here, let's pass it. Secondly, I invite you to listen for a word or a phrase and copy that down. And in this class, it's not plagiarism to borrow an opening line from somebody. And you're going to hear several opening lines that may work for you, and you'd like to start at that place. So I'm going to a text that I found that has Presbyterian origins in it. This is Memoir, A River Runs Through It, Norman MacLean. And it may have echoes for you of a world that you remember. If so, you'll see father in here, you'll see fly fishing, you'll see a minister, you'll see a religious text being discussed. It's very brief, just a couple paragraphs. Any line that enters or causes you to remember something, I would write down and then tell your side of your story. In our family, it begins, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. And we could almost stop right there. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and you might fill in a blank of your own, but I'll read a little bit more of what he says. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John, the favorite, was a dry fly fisherman. It is true that in our home one day a week was given over wholly to religion. On Sunday mornings, my brother Paul and I went to Sunday school and then to morning service to hear our father preach, and in the evenings to Christian Endeavor, and afterwards to evening services to hear our father preach again. In between, on Sunday afternoons, we had to study the Westminster Shorter Catechism for an hour and then recite before we could walk the hills with him while he unwound between the services. But he never asked us more than the first question in the catechism, what is the chief end of man? And we answered together as one of us, so one of us could carry on if the other forgot. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. This always seemed to satisfy our father, as indeed such a beautiful answer should have. And besides, he was anxious to be on the hills where he could restore his soul and be filled again to overflowing for the evening sermon. He didn't ask us any more questions. In our family, there was no clear line between fly fishing and religion, begins the memoir of growing up in a parsonage. Growing up with church, 1, 2, 3, 4 services, and in between studying a text. And I'd like to leap over to the Mennonites for a second memory back into the memory of childhood and questions. This comes from a book, and I'll give it to you because it's not on the board, Questions I Asked My Mother, by Di Brandt, who originally was from Winnipeg, it's B-R-A-N-D-T, and is virtually the first woman who has written texts that are now used in university study, entered the mainstream, shall we say, with her work, who comes out of a Mennonite tradition. And this is one piece, Questions I Asked My Mother. It's the title piece of her collection. And I invite you to go back to questions you may have had. We in the Protestant tradition weren't encouraged to ask questions, were we? I envy, that's what you say of Midrash. It could be this, not only but also, said one Jewish friend to me. We always said, not only but also, another interpretation. My experience is there was one, and it wasn't going to be anyone I contributed to. I was told. So Dai is asking questions here. And in the end, there's a moment of when she experiences mystery. And yesterday I said we were going to talk about religious tradition. And before we finished writing, we were going to talk about moments of mystery that exist outside tradition, outside of the prescribed times to experience God. And this happens in this piece, so that will also be an invitation. Where and when have you experienced moments of wonder that are not inside the church, as MacLean was? This is how it starts, and it's all written in one breath, but I have to take a breath somewhere. You're to see there's no punctuation, no spelling. It's a torrent of questions. Look, when Grandpa died last week, everybody said he's better off where he is because he's in heaven now. He's with God. We should be happy he's gone home. But yesterday, when they put him in the ground, the minister said he's going to be there in the ground till the last trumpet raises the quick and the dead for the final judgment. Now, look, Mom, I can't figure out which is true. It's got to be either up or down. I mean, what's he going to do? Swoop back into his body at the last moment so he can rise with the trumpet call? Or what? I got to know, Mom. What do you think? My mother is sewing. She's incredibly nimble with her fingers. My father marvels at them. She sewed all our clothes since we were born, embroidered and designed them. She bites the thread carefully before answering. Now, Diana, she says. And then she stops. I can see my question is too much for her. Dad, she calls into the other room, come here a minute and listen to what this girl is asking. I have to repeat the whole thing, my voice rising desperately. Well, when Grandpa died last week, everybody said he's better off where he is because he's in heaven, now he's with God. But yesterday when they put him in the ground, the minister said he's going to be in the ground till the last trumpet raises the quick and the dead for the final judgment. And I can't figure out which is true. He's got to be either up or down. What's he going to do? Swoop back into his body at the last moment so he can rise with the trumpet call, or what? They look at each other, complicity in their eyes. I don't think that's a very nice thing to say about Grandpa, she begins. She wouldn't say this if we were alone. It's an introduction. She lets my father finish with the big stuff. It's your attitude, he says. I've noticed lately everything you say has this questioning tone. I don't think you're really interested in Grandpa or your faith. What you really want is to make trouble for Mum and for me, says my father. You've always been like that. You're always trying to figure everything out on your own instead of submitting quietly to the teachings of the church. When are you going to learn not everything has to make sense? Your brain is not the most important thing in the world. What counts is your attitude and your faith, your willingness to accept the mystery of God's ways. I start shivering when I hear this, I have to admit. Well, I just don't know, my mother says. Oh, sorry, I'm skipping on. Sometimes I felt I would just burst with all the unanswered questions inside me. I thought of writing the country guide question and answer column, but I didn't have stationery. And anyway, no one ever asked questions like I did. I imagined heaven as a huge schoolroom where all the questions of the universe were answered once and for all. God was the cosmic school inspector pointing eternally to a chalkboard as big as the sky. Just imagine, I thought, Abraham and Isaac and all those guys, they already know everything they knew about relativity centuries before Einstein. Instantly, like that, they knew. They didn't even have to think. Or so I thought. One time I asked her about bread. I loved smelling the brown yeast in the huge blue speckled bowl, its sweetish ferment, watching it bubble and churn. How does it turn into bread? I asked her. And she has an answer for this. What the yeast is, is what makes it rise, she said. When you add warm water, it grows, as you can see. Yes, but how does it turn into bread? I mean, it comes out a completely different thing. What exactly happens to it in there in the oven? Why does heat turn it into something full of holes we can eat? She sighed. My mother sighed a lot when I was around. You're asking me something I can't tell you, she said. Now help me punch down the dough. I sat in front of the oven all afternoon, bathed in warm kitchen smells, trying to figure it out. Someday, I said to myself, someday, I will find out everything. Meanwhile, sitting by the smell of the bread and the mystery of its rising, and the awareness of the mystery. Questions I asked my mother. Do you have memory of unexplained questions you had and the way you were responded to when you asked them? What you didn't understand and maybe still don't? I'd like to read, that's Dybrand, and I'd like to read one more that invites you to go into any story, and let's assume we all share the biblical text, any story, and add to it. This is what a poet has done, Zimborski, who's the Polish writer, and I couldn't remember how to spell her name, Polish Nobel Prize winner. Zimborski, I believe. She won in maybe 4 years ago, and it's from her collection. It's called Lot's Wife. So she takes Lot's wife, who never said a word, never was given speech. There's at least one other woman in the Bible that never had her side of the story told, I think, and gives Lot's wife the chance to speak. And this is your third possibility today. Which character would you like to re-enter and speak more of his or her story? Let's listen to what she does with Lot's wife, and then we'll start writing. This is Lot's wife talking. It's not about her story. She is telling her story. If there's one thing literature can do, it is to give voice, to give more voice, to give more story in the voice of the character. They say I looked back out of curiosity, but I could have had other reasons. Maybe I looked back mourning my silver bowl. Carelessly, while tying my sandal strap, I looked back. So I wouldn't have to keep staring at the righteous nape of my husband Lot's neck, I looked back. I looked back from the sudden conviction that if I dropped dead, he wouldn't so much as hesitate. I looked back from the disobedience of the meek, checking for pursuers. I looked back, struck by the silence, hoping God had changed his mind. Our two daughters were already vanishing over the hilltop. I felt age within me, distance. I felt the futility of wandering. I looked back, setting my bundle down. I looked back, not knowing where to set my foot. Serpents appeared on my path, spiders, field mice, baby vultures. They were neither good nor evil now. Every living thing was simply creeping or hopping along in mass panic. I looked back in desolation. I looked back in shame because we had stolen away, wanting to cry out, wanting to go home. Only when the sudden gust of wind unbound my hair and lifted up my robe, then I looked back. It seemed to me they were watching from the walls of Sodom and bursting into thunderous laughter again and again. I looked back in anger, to savor their terrible fate. I looked back for all the reasons given above. I looked back involuntarily. It was only a rock that turned underfoot, growling at me. It was a sudden crack that stopped me in my tracks. A hamster on its hind paws tottered on the edge. It was then we both glanced back. No, I ran on. I crept. I flew upward until darkness fell from the heavens. I couldn't breathe and spun around and around. Anyone who saw me must have thought I was dancing. It's not inconceivable that my eyes were open, and it's possible I fell facing the city. It's possible I fell. Maybe it was this, maybe it was that. Now, do you have enough to fill a blank page? Invitation to write, a memory of your own, a Sunday as Norman MacLean did, a relationship with father, questions you asked of mother or father or priest, the desire to tell a story you've heard 100 times and to add to it, or simply, you can do a journal entry from Holden. What's going on? What's your day like today? Where are you in your journey? There is no assignment. Nobody sees this, nobody hears it unless you choose. So it's your own private entry. If necessary, you put brackets and talk back to yourself. End of brackets. Keep going with what you're writing. This is first draft. This is rough draft. This is in the beginning, was the word, is your word.